Ohio has been on a weather roller coaster recently, alternating warmer weather days with cooler temperatures. The result has been a volatile mix of severe weather, including a number of tornadoes spawned from thunderstorms. And the state could potentially set a record for tornadoes this year. But beyond the numbers, there are questions about what's causing this turbulent weather. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. Ahead, we'll talk to a weather and a climate expert about the current weather we're seeing and what it may indicate about climate change. Later, Democrats are still looking for a solution to ensure President Joe Biden will make the Ohio November general election ballot. The problem is the National Nominating Convention puts Biden in conflict with an existing law and ballot deadline. So what's the workaround? Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. Good morning. I'm Jenny Hamill, and thank you so much for joining us. The typical tornado season for Ohio usually begins on April 1st. But this year, severe weather outbreaks, including tornadoes, have been impacting the state since late February. Those storms have impacted nearly all parts of the state, including a tornado in west-central Ohio's Logan County that killed three in March, and a tornado last week that damaged Windham Township in Portage County. The pace of the severe weather has led to predictions the state may potentially set a new record. Currently, the most tornadoes in a year for Ohio is 62, set back in 1992. But beyond the numbers, there are questions about why we're seeing such severe weather outbreaks so early in the year, and what role, if any, a changing climate may be playing. Joining me to have this discussion that I know many of us are excited to learn more about, we have in studio Freddie Ziegler. He is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist for the National Weather Service Cleveland office. Freddie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jenny.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And by phone, we have Dr. Aaron Wilson. He's an Ohio State University Extension Specialist and State Climatologist of Ohio. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. If you would like to join the conversation or have a question, call 866-578-0903. Once again, 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Aaron, we've had two seasons where we've had early outbreaks of severe weather. Some have linked it to climate change. Others say it's too soon to draw that conclusion. Where do you stand?
Yeah, so there's a lot to unpack in that question. Certainly when you've got systems and a season like we've had, it's front and center on everyone's mind. I think it's really good to remember that we do have year-to-year variability or changes in our weather that we can see. And certainly in the past, we've had years of limited tornado numbers by this date or even for the season. And we've had, as you've already mentioned, years that are a little bit higher. But when it comes to sort of detecting trends over the long term, not just here in Ohio, but across the country, the picture gets a little bit more complicated, and there's a lot of reasons for that. So I think we are researching, right, the attribution of severe weather and these highly localized systems and storms, I should say, to climate change. But, we still have a ways to go to increase our confidence that, increasing numbers of tornadoes or other severe weather events can be directly linked to the overall changes in our climate.
Aaron, how do you explain the difference to people between weather and climate?
Yeah, so, there's a lot of famous sort of quotes out there, weather's what you get, climate's what you expect. Often I use the illustration that was developed some years ago, thinking about a dog walker, if you're out walking your dog and you have a dog. That dog meanders back and forth toward, squirrels and fire hydrants and all kinds of things and has that chaotic nature. But if you generally over, a few minutes look at the path that the dog walker's taking, you can see that dog's mean path or average path over a long period of time is like the dog walker. And so we can sort of relate the weather to the chaotic nature of the dog, the ups and downs. That certainly has a relationship to the long-term climate, but climate is describing those changes over a long period of time. That includes averages and also includes the extremes as well. So I think that's a really good illustration to think about these differences.
The imagery works for me. Freddie, I wonder if you agree. And when you think about our relatively mild winter, I mean, I know we had a couple of cold moments, but really it felt mild and very unusual. Do you think that's factored into the weather conditions that have led to the severe weather and tornadoes we're seeing of recent?
I would agree with it, Dr. Wilson. It's a couple of steps before you actually get to the increase of tornadoes or increase of severe weather in the winter months. And we're talking about meteorological winter of December, January, and February. The state of Ohio normally gets a break in these months. And we're talking about the whole state, so northern and southern states. This year and last year, we've seen some activity as far as severe weather breaking out a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. We had an outbreak in February that had occurred, and we're not unique in this aspect. The state of Michigan and also the state of Wisconsin have actually had their first tornadoes in February, so it's starting early for a lot of the Midwest sections. And I think by last week we were actually in the lead as far as tornadoes. I think we were around 35 preliminary numbers for this year so far. Illinois has a large increase. I believe they're in the 30s as well. Indiana as well. So the kind of the Midwest, this kind of, you know, not having a lot of cold fronts come through, that opportunity for warm, moist air to get in place, you mm-hmm. have to have a lot of other ingredients there. You have to have, you know, that southerly winds at the surface and westerly winds aloft to really get things in place. And then you have to have the instability, that warm, moist air, that's the instability. So you have a lot of things that have to be in place. For the Midwest area, Ohio, we generally get a lot of sheared, we're talking about winds in different directions, very strong in late winter and spring. That's our normal pattern. And so if we're getting opportunities of the cold fronts not coming in, we get opportunities that warm air setting up, people enjoying those 70 degrees in February, we're going to pay for that because we're still going to get cold fronts all the way through May and even into June. So we're not, you know, there's going to be a, you're going to create that opportunity. So you're jumping 3, 4, 5 steps before you can actually say there's a strong correlation to climate change with a small scale tornado that may affect the township.
Aaron, technology has improved over the decades that's enabled forecasters to better spot tornadoes. Is that a factor in the number of storms we've counted this year?
Yeah, it probably likely, right, for this year, but also, you know, changes that we've seen really over the last 30 years. And I know atmospheric scientist and researcher Jana Hauser at Ohio State University has done quite a bit of work, you know, looking at trends for the country in different categories from EF0 all the way to EF5. And it's pretty interesting. If you look at the overall number of raw, you know, U.S. tornado trends, we certainly see sort of that bump up in detection when Doppler radar came around, late 80s, 1990-ish. And then again, we had an update to radar technology in around 2011 with dual pole, which allows for a more detailed analysis of the types of particles and debris and things that are in the structure. And so that's helped, you know, help identify, you know, tornado debris structures to be able to help detect more of these weaker EF0, EF1 tornadoes that probably went underrepresented and identified before the early 1970s.
And Aaron, I wonder, let's talk about, I mean, you know, we've definitely talked about in the short term, you can't necessarily say something is climate change. But based on the data currently available from your vantage point at the OSU, are there any climate change trends that you think are attributable in Ohio?
Yeah, there definitely are. You know, when you think about things that are a little bit more broad scale, you think about temperatures, for instance. We've got very strong warming trends, particularly in winter and spring. During the summer, our trends are largely overnight low temperatures are getting warmer, but not necessarily our daytime high. So that's something that, you know, we have a pretty strong confidence in those changes. The other thing we've seen is generally a 5 to 10% in annual precipitation since the early part of the 20th century. And again, there's a strong seasonal signal there across Ohio's over more recent periods, say the last 50 years, where we see really, you know, much wetter winters and springs. And then parts of the state actually show some negative drying trends in the middle of summer. So it's pretty interesting when you look at it both at a regional or local perspective, but also those seasonality changes. And then the other thing about the rainfall that we've seen is certainly an uptick in those more intense rainfall events at the daily scale or the once every 5 year scale, where we've seen heavier, more, you know, one inch or greater events per day all across Ohio in terms of the numbers that we're seeing. And so those are our trends that we have high confidence in. And again, we're not saying that, you know, tornado trends aren't attributed to, you know, climate changes.
Sure.
We don't have the robust scientific certainty to make that statement.
And that's why we asked both of you on. It's for that robust scientific certainty, because we can all guess on hunches, but it's really the science and the data that you know, gives you the proof in the pudding. But as you just mentioned, changes in precipitation, Freddie, the EPA says in the country, 9 of the 10 heaviest days for precipitation have occurred since 1996. So what in your eyes are some of the data points when it comes to believing that climate change is having an impact on Ohio?
I think for Ohio, you know, and this is nationwide, we're looking at, there's been some studies, and I apologize, I don't like to play studies that I don't have the resources right in front of my fingertips, and I'm pretty sure the doctor can actually kind of expound on this one. We've noticed some of the tropical systems are slower, and so if you have a slower tropical system, I know that doesn't affect Ohio, they are going to produce more rain. And so the idea of the frequency of the 1 out of 100 year or 500 are occurring more often, that's significant. And we, what we do is we kind of report to some of the public as far as what's the possibility and how often does it happen. And so we're noticing some trends in that aspect. And even some of the, you know, I released weather balloons for almost 25 years when I was in Louisiana and Amarillo. There was a switch in instrument, but the actual measurement of moisture from the surface to the upper parts of the atmosphere in some areas, well, quite a few areas, have increased. We're slightly above normal, even just looking from day to day. And you kind of see that as a forecaster looking at it every day. You see these numbers are a little bit higher than they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, especially if you're sitting at one location forecasting the weather for 20 years. And I've noticed that even when I was forecasting the weather in Louisiana, that those moisture values have increased just looking at day to day, looking at the forecast. And we have these numbers. We get the numbers from the climate, from some of the regional climate centers to tell us what the moisture is supposed to be at that particular day on April 24th. Is it higher? How much percentage is it higher? And we notice some of those numbers have been creeping up. This is anecdotal, but sure. I'm pretty sure the doctor can possibly can confirm or deny that. But that's, as a forecaster, that's what I've noticed. And just noticing different studies have showed some tropical systems have slowed down, increasing rainfall. I've living on the Gulf Coast, I've never heard of a Hurricane Harvey. I know that doesn't equate to Ohio, but I don't know about mid-latitude systems, and so I haven't had that 10-year stretch where I can kind of really get grasp on it. But I noticed the rainfall, you know, even with the winter time in Ohio, and I know I'm rambling here, most of our precip has been frozen snow for the most part. Last year and this year, we deal with more rain
right
in between those periods and rather than snow. So our snowfall has been down for the last 3 years. And if you look at the last 10 years, they may have had 1 or 2 years that were above normal. So people notice a trend.
Sure.
Especially if they lived in an area for 20 or 30 years.
Sure, sure. I've heard that the winters just aren't what they used to be. You know, I wasn't born and raised here, but I've been told that I've not truly experienced a real Cleveland winter yet, and I've been here for a while. Let's take a call from Scott in Oberlin. Scott, good morning. Give us your thought, please.
Howdy, folks. As somebody that's lived in the Cleveland area for over 60 years, here and there and everything, but I can tell you that we used to count on, you know, winters being cold. It's like you'd go out for trick-or-treat and everything when you were a kid, and you had to really rug up and try to get your costume over your winter clothes. And you could count reliably on going out and getting a good base to go cross-country skiing. And that just doesn't happen anymore. But one of the other things, one of my big concerns with whether you call it climate change or what the driver is, the fact is that we're seeing these crazier weather events. And it's something that people and cities and governments and institutions need to start thinking about, how to build resiliency into your civil construction. So your sewers, your road drainage, your stream management, and then also strengthening your house and everything and your dwellings and your businesses to be able to handle weather extremes, you know, and whether it's going to be heat.
Sure.
Or extreme weather. I mean, with the way things swing, we could have a real cold spell like we had those polar vortexes because of weather instability, you know, and God forbid we get a big melt off in Greenland where you have fresh water coming off that big island and then screwing up the Atlantic flow, and then everything's off, you know, all the plans are off and everything. So,
well, Scott, I appreciate the point, and you make a good point, and I think it's something that's being talked about. Aaron, I'd love to get your thoughts on that as far as the conversations and work being done to recognize the fluctuations, the new and extreme weathers, and how we need to prepare our infrastructure, both regionally and in the state, to prepare for kind of an unpredictable weather future.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott, that's amazing kind of rundown of so much information there that's really tuned into the situation. And we here at the State Climate Office, we have partners and a lot of partners all across the state with the Department of Transportation, Emergency Management, Department of Agriculture. We work with numerous cities and regional planning commissions around the state that are actively thinking about how to build resilience to the many things that you mentioned. Maybe most importantly, thinking about the volatility and the variability. Tonight it's a good example. We've got a pretty good chance of freeze conditions across the northern portions of the state, and warmer winter conditions can set us up for, you know, pretty big horticulture or agricultural losses, depending on the degree of that cold injury and these typical April freezes, right? There's nothing late about an April freeze. But thinking about all the preparation, the resilience building that's going into it, and I had the honor of being the lead author of the Midwest chapter of the 5th National Climate Assessment that was released last November. And we tried to highlight what communities and individuals and the country's really doing to build that resilience, and especially with an eye toward our lower wealth income and communities of color that disproportionately bear the brunt of the decisions and infrastructure and decisions that we've made in the past. So, you know, pulling all of this together, it's not just a climate story, but it's a human story to think about how do we build resilience at the local level. Individual level, local level, state, region, country is really an important endeavor right now. And there's many folks that are doing just that.
Dr. Aaron Wilson, state climatologist of Ohio, and Freddie Ziegler with the National Weather Service Cleveland office. I have a list of questions I haven't even gotten to. We're going to have both of you on again sooner rather than later and talk more about the weather and how our state and regions are preparing. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
All right, let's take a quick break. When we return, how Democrats are working to ensure that President Joe Biden appears on the November ballot in Ohio. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us. Democrats are looking for a way to ensure President Joe Biden will appear on the Ohio ballot in November. Currently, an existing state law requires parties to set their presidential candidates 90 days before the election. The deadline this year falls on August 7th. The hitch is that President Biden will not be formally nominated by Democrats until the national convention. That begins in Chicago, not until August 19th. Democrats are confident, however, that Biden will be on the ballot in Ohio, but the strategy to achieve that goal is still being worked on behind the scenes. Joining me to talk about this issue, we have in studio Dr. Tom Sutton. He is the interim provost and a professor of political science at Baldwin-Wallace University. Dr. Sutton, so glad to have you.
Good to be with you, Jenny.
And by phone, we have from Columbus, our State House News Bureau Chief, Karen Kassler. Karen, thanks for calling in.
Hey, great to talk to you.
If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, call 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Karen, let's talk about this law. It's not a new one, but why was it put into effect in the first place in Ohio?
Well, the law was part of a law that passed in 2010. It set a 90-day deadline for presidential nominations for certification of that. And it was part of a bill that actually set up the way that bonuses could be paid to veterans of the wars in the Persian Gulf, Iraq, and Afghanistan. So the whole connection there, I think, according to Senate President Matt Huffman, is that this is about early voting. And Ohio has 30 days of early voting. You've got to get some of those ballots over to military people overseas. You've got to make sure all that happens. And so that's the 90-day deadline. 90 days, it sounds like, was just a date that was put out there. I mean, other states, you've got two other states that are dealing with this problem, Washington State and Alabama, and they have not 90-day deadlines, but deadlines that are pretty far out. And so twice before, both conventions have been scheduled for after that 90-day deadline. And so the legislature has fixed it and moved it back to a 60-day deadline in 2012 and then before the 2020 election. So that's the question now, is what's going to happen here, because only one convention is affected, the Democratic convention. And the legislature, according to Secretary of State Frank LaRose, has to do something by May 9th. And so far there's no legislative fix. But I will say that Republican leaders, including Senate President Matt Huffman, Attorney General Dave Yost, have said Biden is going to be on the ballot. It's just a question of how it's going to happen.
Tom, so in prior years, this was a fix. It would, and I guess you could call it an easy fix. But do you think that what's happening now, and kind of how people are positioning themselves around this potential kerfuffle, speaks to a growing divide in our politics in the state at all?
Well, I think it's another manifestation of that growing divide. Certainly, we're hyper-partisan. This is a pretty much red state with some possibilities for Democrats. Sherrod Brown certainly hoping for that. But
right.
Really, I think it's everything gets seen through the lens of partisanship now. And so whatever decision is made related to this is going to be seen through that same lens. Now, I have to say this is a problem that basically is both parties' problem, which also I think is where the fix is going to come in, a permanent fix, because as was said just as recently as yesterday, the Republicans, including Stevens, the Speaker of the Ohio House, said, well, we need to be careful because this could affect us as well in the future.
Sure.
So with conventions, there's always that desire to have the convention as close to the election as possible later in the summer. We even had one over Labor Day in 2008 when Obama was nominated.
And what's the rationale for that?
The rationale is that there's this, it's increasingly not being demonstrated by evidence, but the rationale had always been that you get a bump out of the convention and it can help you with that trend line in terms of going into the general election.
Got it.
Now, of course, you've got early voting. Really, voting starts in October for most states these days. Whether the bump has that much effect, polling data basically shows there really isn't that much of an effect unless there's some big surprise at a convention. quite frankly, given these conventions and the issues at hand for both parties, it may be better for them to be earlier and to have more time between the end of their conventions and the election itself.
You know, Tom, the discussion we were having in one of our editorial meetings was, what if the Democratic Party have even an intern or someone who was the dates guy,
yeah, right,
or gal,
right,
who kind of thought, okay, this is when the convention is and this is when, you know, the deadlines are in each state to just make sure that something like this doesn't happen?
Yeah, when you have tens of millions of dollars being spent on the permanent infrastructure of both parties at the national level, and their basic job is to get a presidential nominee nominated and elected, you would think that they would be checking the rules of all 50 states, have done so certainly after this 2010 law passed, and we're not the only state that has a law like that,
right,
and figured out, well, is there a legislative fix that we need to advocate for at the state level, or is there something that needs to be done at the federal level? Because with the presidency being unique as it is, the only real national election we have, and even that's contestable because it's electoral college, you still have that issue of what the courts would say, and we've seen that in the recent decisions about Trump being on the ballot, and what states say. And quite frankly, it is a gray area that at the end of the day, either legislatures figure out how to deal with it or the court's going to decide it for them.
You know, Karen, I think if you're a member of the general public or you're reading these kind of news headlines, there's got to be that gut feeling of, wait a minute, did the Republicans do something that would prevent President Biden from being on the ballot? But really, there are no devious movements made. I mean, I do know that Secretary of State Frank LaRose is getting some heat for waiting until now to inform Democrats. But really, I mean, the onus is not on him.
Right. And he said, his office said that, hey, they were caught up with the primary and all these other things and just noticed this. And that's
right,
why they notify Democrats as kind of a courtesy. But yeah, the question, and LaRose's office has also said, hey, the Democratic Party has a lot of highly paid lawyers who should have noticed this. But it still stands that there is this law that is out there that could potentially keep Biden off the ballot, though it's clear, like I said, Republicans have said that there's going to be some sort of fix. And the question is, what is that going to be? Democrats in Ohio seem to be pushing all this toward the National Democratic Committee and the National Democratic Party. And they've been the ones who've been primarily speaking about what possible solutions there are. And there are, again, two states that have an issue. Alabama just passed a law to fix this. And a piece of legislation. And then Washington State has been talking about some sort of a provisional certification, which the Democratic Party said Ohio could also accept. Attorney General Dave Yost has pushed back on that. So we're still waiting to see what the final resolution is going to be. But I mean, the idea that somehow Republicans are going to keep Biden off the ballot in Ohio, that's not going to happen, according to Republican leaders who said he's going to make it. He's going to be there.
Claudia wrote in just now via email saying, President Biden is the presumptive, certainly most likely candidate. There is, however, a remote possibility that another individual may be the Democratic nominee. My question is this. Will the fixed language account for any and all possibilities to assure a place for whoever the Democratic nominee is on the Ohio ballot?
It's a great question. And in fact, that gets to that point of one of the solutions that was offered was to have some sort of a quiet virtual convention, mini convention, if you will, earlier to meet that deadline, and then Biden would be nominated and that would be the end of it.
Right.
But there are those Democrats that are holding an outside long shot chance that something could happen at the Democratic convention in Chicago. Mm. The last time we had that was in 1968, so we know that change can happen in the city of Chicago.
Sure.
That in mind, I think you have constituencies in the party that you want to keep as Biden supporters or at least vote for him. Who could then be alienated if you tried to do this in a way to keep him on the ballot, but at the same time basically preclude any chance something could happen at a convention?
Okay, let's switch gears very quickly for the last handful of minutes of this conversation. Tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court will hear arguments on a case that could reshape the extent of presidential immunity. Tom, the stakes in the outcome of this case are huge.
Yes.
Both for the former President Trump and federal prosecutors.
So this whole issue of immunity is something that is presumed by practice and constitutional interpretation when someone is in office as the president. The question is, can they be held legally liable for actions they took while being president? Can they be held legally liable for actions they've taken after leaving the White House?
Right.
And those are the real basic questions that the Supreme Court's going to be addressing. And of course, with the numerous charges and cases that former President Trump is facing, this is going to be really a decision that will have a huge impact on his own personal situation. And it's quite possible that the Supreme Court will not make a definitive decision on this question because of all these different variables that are involved in the currently in the office, had been in the office, and the types of things he's been charged with, from civil cases, one of which he's lost now twice,
right,
to a variety of criminal charges involving state and federal law.
I mean, the first and only president to have been to face criminal charges ever. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. And so former President Trump will continue to defend himself and say that this is all an effort to use the legal system against him to try to defeat him rather than defeating him at the polls. His hardcore supporters, every time he's in court, they just see more of wanting to support him, although that's not manifesting in terms of big crowds outside of the courtroom in New York these days. And so it's really, it does get very complicated. We have to keep in the international scheme, though, there are other countries that have placed presidents on trial, former presidents on trial, found them guilty for everything from corruption to war crimes violations, and put them in prison. So it's not that the United States is immune to that, and maybe that's what we're going to be facing coming up.
Wow. Interesting. We have constitutional law professor Jonathan Enten with Case Western Reserve University on the line. Good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for calling in.
Sure. I have an op-ed in today's Plain Dealer that talks a little bit about the idea of litigating the ballot deadline. And I don't want to get into all of the details about this, but as your folks have been saying, the obvious solution here is for the General Assembly to change the deadline on a permanent basis. This is the fourth presidential election since the 90-day deadline was adopted, and it has failed in three of them. They fixed the deadline in 2012. They fixed the deadline in 2020. I mean, at this point, I think whatever the good intentions of the folks who adopted the 90-day deadline, I think we can say it just hasn't worked, and we shouldn't be in the position of having to scramble for a temporary fix. I explain in the op-ed that there are reasons to wonder whether a lawsuit is even the best way to go. There is a decent legal argument, but it's hardly airtight. And even if the lawsuit wins, eventually the General Assembly is going to have to fix this deadline anyway.
I appreciate your call and your thought, and I'm going to have to check out your op-ed. I'm seeing the headline right here. Karen, what do you say to Jonathan's thoughts about the General Assembly making a permanent fix and keeping this out of any sort of courtroom action?
Well, a permanent fix by May 9th, that seems unlikely. I could see it being added to, for instance, House in session or House and Senate are in session today. It wouldn't be done today, but I could see it added to a bill that might pass before May 9th, or maybe some other resolution is going to happen that we have not discussed here yet. But I think the whole idea of the 90-day deadline is really interesting because you have had some members of the legislature, mostly, well, all Republicans, who've talked about their concerns about early voting and that the early voting period is too long or they don't like it or whatever. And I wonder if that 90-day deadline could be a part of a bigger discussion about changing early voting, though certainly Ohioans have embraced early voting and it's been something that people have been using for the many years that it's been in place.
All right. Well, I appreciate you calling in with your thoughts, Jonathan. I'm going to ask Tom and Karen one last question about going back to President Trump and the Supreme Court. And actually, Karen, I'll turn this to you. The former president, Trump, has enormous power and sway in Ohio, essentially kind of rejiggering the state to become red once again. How closely do you think his legal cases are being followed? And what sort of impressions do you think they're making on his supporters?
Well, it's certainly true that Ohio is a red state, but it's not because of Trump. I mean, Ohio has been a reliably red state for quite a while. I mean, you go back 30 years and Republicans have won like 87% of statewide elections. So it's not Trump that is really the key factor here, though President Obama did win Ohio twice. Certainly, Republicans in Ohio have shown their support for Trump. The Ohio Republican Party was the first state in the country to endorse Trump. And so I think it's pretty clear that the expectation is that Trump will win Ohio, but that doesn't mean that Biden won't be on the ballot. So I think that's an important thing to consider, at least.
And Tom, 30 seconds to tell me, has there been any polling of recent to show how the public is feeling about the presidential election?
The polling that I've seen still is showing Trump and Biden neck and neck in many states. The Ohio state polls tend to be showing Trump ahead again by the usual 6 to 8 points. And so, quite frankly, on this issue of putting Biden on the ballot, I would think that for Republicans, given Biden's weak polling ratings that have been consistent for a long time and the growing issues that he's facing, I would think they would want him on the ballot to run against as opposed to not having someone to run against in Ohio.
And certainly, let me add, that if he's not on the ballot, that would affect down-ticket races. I can imagine the Democrats do not want to see Biden in any way barred from the ballot because they're going to be using that relationship.
My thanks to State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, of course, Dr. Tom Sutton from the Baldwin-Wallace University. Thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Jenny.
Great to be here.
Time now for another quick break. We're going to take a short one. On the other side, we'll meet another inspiring person named to this year's Crain's Cleveland Business 8 Over 80 Awards. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for being with us. Crain's Cleveland Business this month named outstanding octogenarians and nonagenarians in its annual 8 Over 80 Awards. These people have been incredible lives and careers that are continuing to make an impact in their community. Last week, we met 81-year-old philanthropist Ron Harrington, who is funding medical discoveries around the world, as well as 83-year-old nonprofit leader Betty Smith, who co-founded Enrichment, that offers music and arts-based classes to children in Stark County. Today, we meet another member on the list, 81-year-old Nick Costas, the longtime proprietor of Pickwick and Frolic, whose combination restaurant, cabaret, and comedy club helped transform downtown Cleveland. Nick Costas, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Well, I thank you.
And I want to congratulate you on this honor. What was your reaction to getting the call saying you were being honored on Crain's 8 Over 80 list?
Oh, I said, my 80? I didn't realize until they called. And then I felt very old.
Was there an honor involved as well?
Well, an honor only in the sense that somebody recognizes that you've been around too long.
Well, let's talk about your upbringing. You were born in Brooklyn, New York, but you have since adopted Cleveland as your hometown.
Yes.
What do you love about Cleveland?
Oh, this town, you know, I came to this city as for an event when I with my folks. It was a big family gathering that took place in Cleveland at the old Pick Carter Hotel. And I love the scale of the city, you know. From Brooklyn, of course, and in New York, you know, you're dwarfed by the size and the population and the streets and the, you know, the hustle and the traffic. Whereas here, it seemed like you could consider it. You could it had a scale that was comfortable. I remember running in a rainstorm with some other kids from the Pick Carter down to where Higbee's was. I just remember coming to the corner of Ontario and Prospect there, where you saw that blunted edge of the building, which is now the entrance for that walkway that comes from the parking garage into the casino. And I don't know why, it just made an impression on me. But the biggest thing was, I thought the people here were great.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, the kids I met, and it was just a very warm, a welcoming, friendly city. That's the way I regarded it, compared to what I was accustomed to.
And you began your career in education.
Mm-hmm.
You worked with students at several school districts before you eventually got into the hospitality industry.
Mm-hmm.
So what led you from students, kids, to eventually getting into the restaurant and entertainment world?
Well, it's a rather circuitous route, I know, but I guess I would say that when I think about life as I look back on it, there are things that you wonder, you ask yourself, what inspired you? What little spark of creativity that occurred to you? And maybe it isn't so much creativity as it is just some kind of pull that might be it might be embedded in our psyches when we're born. I don't know, we might inherit some sort of predisposition towards certain characteristics, not only in our personality, but certain experiences that we pursue because of something that is in us. Well, for me, as far back as I can remember, I just, you know, I'm one of these people, you know that song, people who love people are the luckiest people in the world? Well, that's it in a nutshell. I feel very fortunate. I like to see people happy. And so I sought out, you know, vocations and avocations that put me in a position to support people, to lift people, to embrace and nurture people. Hence my sojourn into education, into counseling, into I was a school psychologist for many years, and then I started a small business. So that's what got me first into the vending industry, and then subsequently through that into hospitality. And there I was in a business where I was meeting tavern owners and placing and creating, building, opening game rooms, which were very popular at the time. So that business actually put me into my first kind of entree into hospitality. One of those businesses had a back room. The back room was basically empty, and I at one point used it to park my truck. And then one day, my partner at the time and I reasoned that, why don't we pull the truck out of here and sublease this space, not only for a garage, but maybe let's make it a restaurant. And that little restaurant became the Little Bar and Grill. And the story there is there was a place called the Little Bar next to the old Roxy Burlesque House on East 9th Street. Next to the old Roxy Burlesque House, there was a little place called the Little Bar. And a wonderful man, Mr. Portellis, owned it. He had passed away. And we purchased the license from the estate and placed it there on Frankfurt, right behind what is now Johnny's. Well, we pulled the truck out, and we built a restaurant, and that was the bite. I loved it. I've really finally found a home, and it was a way to make people happy.
And the Little Bar and Grill, the Little Bar and Grill helped transform the historic warehouse district in 1984. And then Pickwick and Frolic helped transform the East 4th District in Cleveland in 2002. What do you think allows you to see the potential of a place before many others do?
Well, you know, I'm not so sure I saw anything. I knew what I wanted to do. So it's driven by, you know, I liken it to the old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland movies, Andy Hardy series of movies where the kids all got together and they said, hey, let's have a show. And the show turned into this Broadway extravaganza. Well, it was more the delight of, can we create something that draws people to something that otherwise is dormant and dark?
Yeah.
And thereby create an atmosphere where people feel welcomed and happy.
So the Hilarities Comedy Clubs that you opened beginning in 1985 have been a launching pad for some pretty notable acts, including Jerry Seinfeld, Steve Harvey, Drew Carey. Can you tell me when you see a new act, oh, this one might be super famous one day?
Well, sometimes Ray Charles could see it. It's a case of listening, watching not only their sense of presence on the stage, but it's, you know, actually it not only has to kind of affect and impact you, but you see how their vocalization, their instrument is used to affect people. The magic of a comedy venue, which is what I was really drawn to and fit with my kind of journey in life, was that here were people that came into a space, attended to some one source of stimuli coming from a stage, attending to this voice and this animated figure who relates a story, and the story is about us. It gives us, you know, these comedians, they're not historians or philosophers, but they do translate the popular culture into the vernacular, something we relate to and understand. So they are mirrors to us. Well, there are some acts that can do that and see and hone and zone in on a little frame of reference that we relate to instantly. And that little frame, that little recollection of their own childhood, their own family, their own upbringing, is something that sometimes sparks a recognition in an audience. And we are looking at ourselves, laughing at ourselves and our own experience.
So that's a good comedian.
That's a good comedian.
Let me ask you about Cleveland's prospects today. You know, there's a lot of talk about the population loss, the post-pandemic struggles. You're a man who knew when, well, you leapt in to make a business, and a couple of those really stuck and thrived. So what do you think for Cleveland's prospects? Is there anything that can be added to the secret sauce?
Well, now you're... Now we're talking about a bigger crystal ball. My sense of Cleveland has always been that it is, and what appealed to me was the kind of blue-collar nature of the city. Unpretentious, hardworking. I really believed in that. I still do. I think that's the promise of Cleveland. That there are people here who are of here. They're not everybody's a transplant here. I had businesses in Florida, and for me, Florida, there was no culture there. Here, there is a culture, there is history, there are roots. People are rooted here, and I love the sense of pride that they carry. Sometimes maybe too far, but pride nonetheless. So I think that carries you forward. It is what gives us our identity and our sense of who we are and where we are. We laugh at ourselves. I think that's healthy. We look at ourselves. That's very healthy. I hope that as the city develops the grand plans I hear and see on paper as ideas, I hope we don't forget or abandon the notion that it really needs to be populated. These businesses, these storefronts need to be populated with people who are originals, not chains. Chains are wonderful. The chain concept absolutely works. The scale of them absolutely carries them forward. But those little one-man, one-woman shows that are businesses, startups, mom-and-pops, family-owned and operated, if we lose that, then we become just a big mall of chains. That's not us.
So if you were to give a young person who said, hey, maybe I'll start a comedy club or a restaurant in Cleveland, you're saying don't lose your individuality.
Absolutely. I guess what I would say to somebody starting any business, whether it's in hospitality or anything else, find your passion. That's easy to say, and it's been said many times. But pay attention to your dreams. I just described how I grew up, maybe a little bit about how I grew up. But it starts, that little spark starts with a dream, something that you experience in some manner or form. Pay attention to your dreams, because dreams do come true. But you have to pursue them, and you have to be, you know, there's a saying, if you can't go within, you go without. You have to be sensitive. You have to be sensitive to your surroundings. You have to be introspective. You can't be false to yourself nor to any man. That's a principle for living. If you can apply that to a business concept, I think you're on your way.
Nick Costas, thank you so much for speaking with me about your life and your career.
Well, I thank you for having me.
To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We are on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at JennyHamill_, or you can follow me on Instagram, my new Instagram page, JennyHamillIdeaStream. We got a lot of engagement on yesterday's show when we were talking about the practice of zero waste and how to be better environmental stewards when it comes to waste and composting and recycling. Nancy wrote in via email with this suggestion. You can take your own container to the bakery or deli instead of getting your food in another plastic container or box. And Sandy suggested that restaurants do this via email. She wrote, offer the choice on takeout orders of whether or not customer wants it. A simple yes, I want them, or no, I don't need them on the online ordering page would be helpful. I'm assuming she's talking about some of the plastic forks, knives, and extra bags. Thanks, Nancy and Sandy, for writing in, and keep that feedback coming. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, we'll look at the region's air quality and why experts believe a robust tree canopy is vital to clean air. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online. Listen to The Sound of Ideas podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll speak with you again tomorrow.
The Sound of Ideas is produced by Rachel Rude, Lee Barr, Drew Mazias, and Jay Shaw. Chris Dudley and Samson Auble provide technical assistance. Jay Nungesser is at the controls of the Ohio Channel broadcast, and our host is Jenny Hamill. Thanks for tuning in.